questions haunt every life, writes Andy Crouch. The first, what are we meant to be? The second, why are we so far from what we're meant to be? Hello and welcome to Restoring the Soul, a podcast dedicated to helping you close the gap from what you're meant to be and what keeps you from being all that. I'm your producer, Brian Beatty, welcoming you to this edition of Restoring the Soul with Michael John Cusick. If you just found us, thanks for listening. And if you're a longtime supporter, we do appreciate the partnership and trust you're growing right along with us. If you could, do us a favor. We'd love to hear from you. Either a note of encouragement, a suggested guest or topic, or just let us know you're out there. You can drop an email to media@restoringthesoul.com. That's media@restoringthesoul.com. And while you're at it, be sure to tell a friend about the podcast. And now here's your host, Michael John Cusick.
Hey, everybody, it is Michael, and it's a special program today, but I think I say that all the time. But today's guest on the program is my dad, James Edward Cusick, known better by those who loved him as Jim Cusick, who is going to be giving a 50-minute talk from speaking at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting when he was 80 years old. This past summer, I was cleaning out some boxes, and I found a compact disc of my dad giving what is called an AA lead. There are discussion meetings and then speaker meetings, and he regularly gave his story at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And as I found this, there were several reasons why I wanted to share it with the podcast audience at Restoring the Soul. First of all, most of us will never have a chance to attend an AA meeting or any other kind of 12-step group, and this is a way of hearing kind of the meat of what happens at an AA meeting. And if we have been to an AA meeting, most of us won't have the opportunity to listen to an octogenarian tell his story of going from being a drunk to a relatively emotionally healthy man with a family of five. And then finally, I've been thinking a lot about the word legacy and how when any of us does our healing work, when one of us gets sober, when one of us enters recovery, when one of us goes to counseling, we often think just in terms of the benefits to us, but the impact is really multi-generational. And so as you hear my dad share his story about being drunk over and over and arrested five different times while he was in the military, just think about the idea of legacy. And if my dad hadn't gotten sober and beyond sobriety, gone on to really do the work of recovery, I probably wouldn't be speaking into the microphone right now, and you wouldn't be listening to me. And so for each of us, may we have a new vision for how the little steps of obedience and alignment and restoration that we experience, how those go out like a stone dropped into a pond with concentric circles in directions that we could just never know, and even in generational ways pouring out. So with no further ado, here is my dad speaking at Alcoholics Anonymous on Restoring the Soul.
Good evening, friends. Gar, how do I sound? Am I in the right place?
You're in the right place.
I think I need to say that I was, and I am, and I will always be an alcoholic. I feel that in all parts of my body, I know that's true. I had an awful battle accepting my alcoholism. And before I say anything more, there's some people here I need to say thank you to. I had a car. I just moved up from Ohio last summer. I had a car. Oh, Marcella, hi. Pardon me. But I had an accident and I hung up my driver's license. So a number of people, Gar and Barb, David and Marilyn, Joe and Myla, and David and Marcella, you're the ones that brought me here last summer. Thank you. It's good to be here tonight. and to share my gift of sobriety. I love being sober. These are the happiest days of my life. As long as I stay in touch with sober people and keep my nose in the big book and don't take that first drink, I'm going to have uninterrupted sobriety. I don't want to change my sobriety date. I can tell you that I had my last drink in 1972, but it took me a long, long time, 15 or 20 years, to get to 1972. I was exposed to AA in the 1950s. I had a brother who got sober in 1957. In Cleveland, every Memorial Day, they've developed a tradition there. It started out with six guys. They met in a donut shop. They went to church, and then they went for coffee and donuts. And the church thing was all about remembering the deceased members of AA in that town, Cleveland. And over the years, it grew until they'd have it in a hotel dining room, or they did last time I was there. So in the late 50s, my brother had my number. He knew I was an alcoholic. And he invited me to come to this Memorial Day meeting. They used to bring speakers in from the West Coast, Jack Bailey, and a lot of celebrities, but they were all good messages. And I had the good fortune to be there. This was 58, 59. And I thought, gee, this is a nice bunch of people, you know. I thought, they're like philosophers. They say all these cute things. This is a nice bunch of people. My brother gave me a stack of grapevines one time, and I thought, man, here's more of that philosophy. These are nice. But I never once associated what the speaker at that Memorial Day meeting said or the grapevine, never got through my defenses. Alcohol, I know today, alcohol had me by the throat for a good long time. I kind of drank my way through high school, like a lot of kids did. And by the way, I don't know about an hour, they taught me in Cleveland that you can't save any souls after a half hour. So I don't know what's going to happen. But in high school, I was not an athlete. I was not a good student. I kind of began a lifelong pattern of squandering my resources, such as I had. Any talent I had or money, I never got anywhere. And to be very blunt with you, I never learned how to swim or dance or bowl or golf. All I ever did was drink. I'm Irish, and I thought, that's my tradition, you know, I'm supposed to drink. And it just fit right in with the fact that I was not a well-rounded person socially. I was not. And there's a little suburb half hour away from the city I lived in, where when I was 15, it was a beer and wine joint. They used to sell beer and wine to people underage. And I spent many, many evenings in that place. It became a pattern. When I got out of high school, I entered an apprenticeship in the printing trade, and I stayed there a while, and there was an economic slowdown, and I got laid off. So a friend we went to grade school together, we said, you know, some people say join the Navy to see the world, but we joined the Air Force. I found myself down in Texas very soon for 13 weeks. Before I knew it, without any technical training, they sent me overseas. And they let me be, sent me to school overseas, and I became an aircraft engine mechanic with the propellers. I never worked on a jet. I was on the island of Guam in the Pacific for 1 year, and I gotta say that was a wasted year. The GIs were prohibited. All the native villages were off limits. and not much to do except sit around and swat mosquitoes and drink beer. Just about the time that my 1 year overseas tour was completed and I was ready to come back to the U.S., that Korean War started, and I got moved to Clark Field in Manila. And by the way, everywhere I went in the military, I got arrested for drinking out of an open container or brawling, a lot of things. And I never got arrested for jaywalking. It was always, you know, for being intox everywhere I went. In fact, I was out in the Pacific 2.5 years. When I came home, I got arrested twice the first night home in San Francisco. Twice. The funny thing, that the sergeant that was running the jail, I went in and bought a bottle of whiskey. I was going to celebrate him back home. And the military police, I guess they knew that area, and they were just watching. We came out the back door of the liquor store, broke the bottle open, we began drinking, and here comes the MPs. And all they wanted was the bottle. They said, give us the bottle, and we'll let you go. And I couldn't do that. Myself arguing with them, and they don't have to argue, and they told me so. So they took the bottle and they put me in jail. And I was there a couple hours, and one of the sergeants in jail was from Cleveland, and he recognized my serial number that I was from Ohio. So. He kind of winked at me, and he let me out. But I was not intoxicated. I just had one or two drinks, and I got arrested. So I get out. But I went into the bar and said hello to a girl, and there was a soldier sitting on the other side of her. And he didn't like that, so here I got involved in a brawl, and I got arrested again. So that's... That's my two times in one night thing. You know, I wanted to say, I've been able to remember a little thing out of the 24-hour book. It kind of dictates my life. My feet have been set upon the right path. I feel it in the depths of my being. I'm going in the right direction. That's for December 28th out of our 24-hour book. And I live by that. I'm very comfortable letting the world know and letting me know. I no longer had to be convinced. You know, when it came time to ask for help, I did not do this intentionally, but all my years kicking around in the Pacific and getting rested, and I tried to steal a train once. I did. An electric train, it wouldn't go, or I would have. I was working one night with another GI. He had a civilian pilot's license, but he was a buck sergeant. He was a mechanic. He wasn't a pilot. And there were some C-47s there, those old two-wheel prop jobs. He said, let's go for a ride. And we got in this thing, and we both had taxi cars. We could taxi the aircraft from maintenance down to the terminal, but no, we weren't allowed to fly them. But he said, let's go for a ride. And he began going down the runway, and I thought he was going to take off. But at the last minute, he realized, better not do this. You know, back to the 24-hour book again. A lot of us probably read the 24-hour book today. I just came on two sentences. It only takes a minute. But this is so profound, and so it means a lot more than anything that I'm going to say tonight. And by the way, you know, I never figured out anything, how to get here, what to do after I got here. I never figured out anything. It was all given to me by God as I understand Him and all you good people, you sober people. Again, this is from today's meditation in our little black book. Where God's Spirit is, there is your home. There is heaven for you. And I like that. It warms my heart. So I got sent up to Tokyo to go to school, and I went to a lot of tech schools on the island of Guam. So I did my work for a while, but when I really got cranked up with my drinking, I didn't do my work. I'd push it on somebody else. Lots of times we worked different shifts, and if I worked 3 to 11, I'd have a case of beer or two in the airplane all evening long. Very seldom did anything. What happened was, I understand today in the military, if people have a problem drinking or drugging, they confront them and they put them in treatment. But I was in from 1948 to 1952, and there was no confronting then. They looked the other way. I had a lot of people call me, my friends, a lot of NCOs who I worked under. There was one tech sergeant in a barracks. He lived in the same barracks I did. And I worked for him on the afternoon shift. And in the morning, I was sitting on my bunk drinking out of a bottle. And he came over to me and he said, "Jim, you have to work this afternoon." Well, we all know something about alcoholic thinking, how it can cause us to not understand. I know that's why I did all the things I did, because my addiction short-circuited my brain. I know that to be a fact. It's so clear today. That's a nice part about getting sober, that we can see pretty well in what was going on back there, how sick we were. As I went along there, a lot of people, my closest friends, talked to me. They said, "Jim, we think you're going over the edge." I was never ready for inspection, and my uniforms were always dirty. And I remember once I was at a Tachikawa Air Force Base near Tokyo, and I was to catch a flight. We were all moving down to the southernmost Japanese island, Kyushu. I believe that's where the aborted invasion of Japan was to take place in November 1945, but thank God that didn't have to happen. But I missed the airplane, the 7 o'clock departure. I had come in late, and I stopped in the mess hall to get some scrambled eggs. I'm sorry, fried eggs. I used to eat those every morning, and I used to tell myself, of course, I was only 19 or 20 years old, and I used to kid myself that I could stay out all night, and I still have a lot of energy because I eat those fried eggs. But as the time went by, my superiors kind of got tired of pleading with me and telling me, the captain, who was my commanding officer, we were in Korea at that time, and I got a hold of a bottle of some kind of liquid, and it had wooden chips in it. I don't know if they came from a barrel or what. It looked like milk, but I must have bought it from somebody, and I began drinking it. And my commanding officer happened to be there, and he called me. He said, "You know, you're an alcoholic." And a lot of people told me that, but he might as well have been speaking, you know, Greek or Chinese. I just didn't, not me. I have to tell you, my parents were not drinkers. They were social drinkers. And I always wanted to be like my father. Although I know today I didn't even come close, but I wanted to be. I had two siblings, a brother and a sister, recovered in AA, and my sister told me once that when she, my sister, told our mother that I was in AA, our mother said, in the name of God, what have I done to have three of them? So, but I was sober when she died, but my father passed and I was still drinking. One of the things that I like to talk about is little bits of things that have helped me along the way. My favorite definition of alcoholism is, alcoholism is a disease manifested by consistently undesirable results following the ingestion of alcohol. And that's pretty all-inclusive. Every time I drank, I got drunk. My last year of service, I was supposed to be discharged after 3 years, but because of the Korean War, everybody in the military got extended for an extra year. And I got sent out to Idaho, to a Mountain Home Air Force Base. It had been closed ever since 1948, after the big war. And they had one aircraft there. And I was on that base for a year, and it was a couple hundred mechanics. I never touched the aircraft. But that's Uncle Sam. We sat in a hangar and drank Coke and played cards and whatnot. I got in a lot of trouble in Idaho. I was arrested for impersonating an FBI man. That happened. It's a very long story, so just believe me, it happened. And, I got called to base headquarters. My first sergeant came and got me in his car. I didn't know where we were going or why. I had gotten arrested in town for being drunk. I didn't know, but most of you guys know, when you get arrested, they take your belt and your wallet and so on. And they took my wallet and they go through it. I mean, this checking people, the security stuff didn't just start in the last few years. I think the police are always looking for people who are on the wrong side of the law. Well, I had a little card in my wallet that said I was a special agent of the FBI. And it was signed by you-know-who, but it said J. Edgar Hoover. My first sergeant walked me into the room, and there was a gentleman in there. He shook hands and he said, Sergeant, how long have you been with the FBI? And I said, no, not me. But I told him the truth, and it turned out he interrogated me for 2 days. Fingerprints, pictures, and all my siblings and relatives, he wanted to know everything about me. And I was fortunate. I had a sister who was a nun in a Carmelite monastery in Cleveland. And I mentioned her along with my other siblings. And at the end of the day, the FBI man said, you can go in peace. He said, I'm going to recommend that we do not prosecute you. And he said, if you want to know why, he said, I was in the seminary for 4 or 5 years, and he said, I'm giving you a break. So, but he told me, Mr. Hoover doesn't like people signing his name. So that whole year I spent in Idaho was wasted. As they say, I'm a big believer in the progression of the disease. It keeps squeezing tighter and tighter. I also want to say, I love it up here in Michigan that you all, and I'm not from the South either, you all read that, how it works. And I love to hear that because the words cunning, baffling, and powerful are in there. And I can, whenever that is read, I can just feel that, how cunning alcohol is. And how baffling it is, and how powerful it is to our lives, what it did to all of us. I spent 3 or 4 overnights in jail, but I never got put in the guardhouse. They just kept looking the other way. The men that I worked for, I was in a maintenance gang. Each gang had their own aircraft to take care of. And my superior told me many, many times, He said, Jim, if you stay on the base at night and do your work, he said, we could make you a flight engineer. And that's, I'd be in flying status, I'd get a 50% pay raise, and a lot of prestige. But again, he might as well have been speaking Chinese, because what he said, it did not appeal to me. I thought, he wants me to stop going downtown so I could be a flight engineer? And that never happened. And I went on my merry way. I already told you that my brother took me to the meetings, Memorial Day meetings in Cleveland. Then in 1964, I had no interest in getting sober. I can tell you that I was in such awful denial that I was in my early 30s before I ever had any idea that I had a drinking problem. I will share with you, when I came home from the military, my parents lived in the family home, all the other kids were gone, and I moved in. And within the first couple days, in Ohio, that's where I come from, you had to buy alcohol in state liquor stores at that time. I went and bought a case, a 12-bottle case of Seagram's VO, and I put it in my father's fruit cellar where he kept his potatoes and all that good stuff. And here I come, many years later, in the hospital, I learned about protecting the supply, how that's one thing that alcoholics do. They don't want to run out. And here I am with this case of whiskey. And I remember one of the results of that was, I get up and went to church one Sunday, 12 o'clock noon. I was able to make it out to that. Then I came home. I must have been able to eat at that time because my mother made a bunch of eggs and stuff. And I had gone down and gotten one of my bottles, and I at the kitchen table, I poured half a glass of whiskey. My mother, God rest her, she said, Jimmy, you can't drink like that. And of course, it angered me. I was, my God, how did she dare say that to me? That's one thing I'm good at. I happen to have a large capacity, although you guys know what happens when your capacity goes down. They say the trouble goes up. And that was true in my case. In the last year or so, I just have one or two drinks, and my tongue would get twisted. I lost that capacity. My mother, by the way, I learned this from an older sister, that my mother had a sister who died at age 19 from acute alcoholism. But that's probably why she was so upset that I was going to have a half a glass of whiskey with my breakfast. And I went along, and you know, when I was drinking while I was in the military, I never once thought, what am I going to do when I get home? Will I continue to drink? I don't think alcoholics think that way. I just thought, day at a time. I just enjoy today, and that'll take care of itself, the future. And it happens that in 1964, when I, for several years, I can tell you, I never tried to quit drinking. Once I realized, here I am, 31, 32, and I think, hey, there's something wrong. I remember I was building some bedrooms up in a house we lived in Cleveland, nailing up drywall on a Sunday afternoon, and my wife came up and she offered me a Manhattan cocktail. And I remember this real well. I could see an image in my mind of a green devil with horns. And I was getting a message from somewhere, I don't know where, that stuff was bad for me. So I tried. I had a long control period. I promised my wife so many times, and I know I really meant it. I told her, okay, I'll just have a little bit tonight. And she said, why don't you take a little small bottle like everybody else does? And I always took a fifth or a quarter. And I said, that's not my style. I can't do it. I have a pint. And again, I didn't feel at that time, and I don't feel tonight, that I was conning her or BSing her. I just, alcoholic thinking. Yeah, I'm just going to have a couple. And I lost a lot of friends that way, really. I remember going to a New Year's Eve party in an adjacent suburb. I found another printer to hang out with. I was married by this time. And we began drinking doubles. And pretty soon I was punching out windows and acting very badly. And the man drove me home. And he worked in the same plant that I did, the host of this party. And he never spoke to me again. So you do tend to lose friends. And in my recovery, I was fortunate. I had read the book, the big book, a lot of times, but it takes a lot of time before you tend to miss a lot of things. I did. Maybe 15, 20 years ago, I came across that statement in Dr. Bob's Nightmare around page 170, where it reveals that Ann Smith got tired of Dr. Bob getting drunk at a party. And when they would plan to go out somewhere, she said, you go by yourself. I don't want to go with you. And for the same reason, they rarely had friends in. And that happened in my life. It happened in my marriage. My wife said, you go by yourself. So everything was not peachy keen. I was a sick guy. And getting sicker each day, each week, until 1964 at a family, a wedding. Here I am with the photographer. I always found a drinker to hook up with, and my wife and family were eating, and I'm sitting out front with this photographer drinking doubles. And eventually I had to be carried out to my car. I began to experience a lot of remorse and guilt now at that point. For my drinking. I drank so many years, and I just thought that this is what I'm supposed to do. But then I began to catch on. There's something wrong here. You're supposed to drink. By the way, when I was 19 on the island of Guam, I have a photograph of this. Somebody happened to take my picture. It was Christmas time, and my family sent me a little Christmas tree and a chicken in a can and a lot of other things. And I had a bottle for the occasion. And as I sat there, I remember thinking, you know, this drinking is good. I really enjoy feeling mellow like this. And I took an oath. I decided, you know, I like the way I feel when I drink. I'm going to try to just stay. Don't go over the edge. I'm just going to try to stay mellow the rest of my days. And I think that's what happened. That's what drove my drinking. And I'm quick to say, oh, I never volunteered. I want to be a drunk. But maybe right there that day, maybe that was my declaration. I'm a drinker. Leave me alone. But I woke up in the middle of the night that night. I was in bed, and I woke up from my stupor. I was sweating, and I sat up, and of course I was all alone, and I sat up in the dark, and remember I had been trying to control, and of course people in AA have told me, if you're trying to control it, it's already too late, you're an alkie. And I understand that today, but I sat up in bed that night, and I said, Jim, pardon my street language, I said, you are bullshitting yourself. You can't handle a drink. I was quite filled with remorse. I got carried out of that wedding. A lot of relatives there, my children, my wife. I didn't feel very good about that. So that was over the weekend. Monday, I called my brother Tom, who was sober in AA 7 years at the time. He died in 1998. He had 42 years interrupted. I'm sorry, uninterrupted. I called Tom and talked to him about it, and he said, well, throw your hat in the ring. Come on. And there came my denial again. I had an awful battle with that. I wanted to be like my father, and if I admitted I were an alcoholic, I couldn't be like my father. He was a social drinker, and I was, and I am today, an unsuccessful social drinker. So I did not accept my brother's invitation to go to meetings. I thought, hey, I'll be okay. And I went along. I'm one of those people, never got a DUI. Having a few friends here in Michigan, I recently learned that the Who Me pamphlet is not used in this area, in AA. But in Cleveland, it is. It's widely used. It's a little question, 43 questions for the new person to look at. And it reveals that if you have one yes, you might be an alcoholic. If you have two, you are probably two yeses out of 43 questions. Two yeses, you are probably an alcoholic. And if you have three yeses, you're definitely an alcoholic. And I had over 30 yeses. But you've heard that thing, denial is not just a river in Egypt. And that was big in my life. My favorite AA, my dearest friend in Cleveland, when he used to start out to lead a meeting, he would always say, I never wanted to be a drunk. And I could say the same thing, but I think that goes for all of us. We didn't want to be drunks, but everything fit together. And I was very shy as a kid, but I don't think that's why I became an alcoholic. It's just in the nature of things that it was in my family. I had two siblings, well, two that sobered up, a couple more that never bothered to get sober. So back to my days in the Air Force. You know, the war in Korea was a United Nations effort, and there were Filipinos and Greeks and a lot of different nationalities in that war. And the people that I worked for, I worked on DC-4s as an engine mechanic, and they got tired of finding me sleeping, coming late, or not doing my work. And they shipped me out of the squadron I was in. There was a Greek squadron, the Royal Hellenic Air Force, and they put me with the Greeks. And I didn't know what to think about that. And I was working on a four-engine aircraft, and now none of those men spoke English, and I didn't speak a Greek. And at that point, it's just all a big mystery to me. I don't remember much beyond that until in the next few months, I think, they put me on a boat. I remember stopping at Okinawa, and they had a dance band on the pier there welcoming us. I even remember the song they played. So, here I am home now, single, and I do need to tell you something I heard at those Memorial Day meetings in Cleveland way back in the 1950s. It stuck with me. I can remember it tonight, that the speaker that they had for that particular Memorial Day, they had it in a big hotel dining room, probably 2,000 people there. This man was blind. His name was Tom Keenan, and he was from Barberton, Ohio, and he came with his guide dog. And Keenan was the speaker. And this is in the 50s, and I don't know anything about AA, but this stuck with me. He said, the Lord has given me a clean garment, and he was referring to his sobriety. I figured that out many years later. And he said, when I go to the Lord at the end of my life, he said, I want to have a clean garment. I don't want to stain my garment, and that means a lot to me today. You know, how come I'm sober? And you know, probably the biggest reason I'm sober and I love it is because I found something better than drinking. You know, I think any alcoholic could say that not drinking is ever so much better for me and people like me than drinking was. I try not to spend too much time looking back, you know, why did I do those things? I have a pretty good, over the years I've been given a lot of answers. So tonight that I have more answers than I do questions. I have what the big book refers to as happy sobriety. I'm not drinking and I'm happy about it. I experienced for almost 5 years abstinence. 1967, January 6th, I came in. January 6th, I went to my first meeting. Just how the disease did such a number on me for so many years, I went 5 years going to 3 meetings a week, and I told my sponsor, I told people I knew. A dear friend drove me up to, if you know where Chautauqua is in New York, they have an August conference up there. And he knew I was still sick, and he drove me up in his car up to Chautauqua. We stayed there all day and went to the meeting. We had hours and hours to talk in the car. But as we walked around the beautiful grounds at Chautauqua, I saw a lot of beautiful white homes there, green grass. And I saw some folks sitting out on their stone patio drinking what looked like martinis to me. And right away, I just seeing somebody drink, it turned me on. And I said to my friend Mike, this thing is never going to work for me. I still, where I saw those people drinking, I wanted to drink. Somehow, some way, my brother and some other AAs put me in a psychiatric ward at Charity Hospital in Cleveland, 1972. And I had the great good fortune of near on another floor was the Rosary Hall Treatment Center, a dryout unit where the famed Sister Ignatia worked, sobering up drunks with Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob. So I was in that psych ward for 5 weeks. And after I was in there 2 or 3 weeks, they give you a psychological test, and the nurses take down what you're doing, what you're saying. And I was there about 3 weeks when a psychiatrist came in. And he came in every Tuesday, and he'd call. He went to a little room. He told me this day. He said, I don't know if I said my last name when I got up here tonight or not, but my last name rhymes with music. It is Cusick. So, the doctor said to me, I've looked you over, I've evaluated you, and he said, you are immature and you are an alcoholic. And he said, you have to learn how to live without drinking. And he said, my prescription for you is to go over to Rosary Hall, a priest on the staff there who was recovering. He lectured the patients 3 times a day, and my shrink said, you go over and listen to Father John McCarthy. And I did. And, you know, while I was in there in that psych ward, I was sitting on my bed one day, and call it an awakening. It was just my time for things. Thank God it was my time. And I could still be out there. I didn't drink that much. People used to take me to the prisons, to AA meetings. And I thought, man, I never had a number. What am I doing in here? But when I went over to Rosary Hall and listened to Father John McCarthy work his magic, I began to get well in there. But as I sat in my bed one day, I asked myself, why am I in here? Why, you know, it's not the greatest thing in the world. I had a good job and a skilled trade. was in a printing business then, and I asked myself one day, nobody around, what am I doing in here? I remember telling myself, Jim, you have no record of poor mental health. You know, I always got through life okay. The only enemy I had was the bottle. So I told myself, you know, it's not, you're not in here in a nut ward because you're nuts. And then my next thought, my next expression was, Jim, it's the alcohol. And that was when my resistance, my denial began to come apart. And I started remembering all the times I was arrested. And, well, I'd be marching in a parade, and a commanding officer would tap me on the shoulder and say, I want to see you after the parade. I had pants on like I'm wearing tonight, except they were all dirty and smudged, and that doesn't get it in a parade. So I got out, and I went to the meeting with a new attitude. And a dear friend, Jim, he said, you're a new man now. You got drunk and you went out. He said, you're a new man. He said, and he mentioned a new AA group that was starting up on the west side of Cleveland where I live. And he said, why don't you affiliate yourself with that group and you can grow right along with the new group? And I did that. And, you know, I happened to be sitting next to that man many years later. He stood up for 30 years. And after the meeting, I asked him, do you remember telling me that to join this Madison Saturday group? He said no, but he helped so many people and he was so active that I kind of understood why he didn't remember saying that to me. But the big thing is that I remembered. And he got me involved in the Saturday night group. There were a lot of things there that worked for me. The secretary of that group, the permanent secretary, was a former Marine. He was 6'4", 6'5", Bill Wetzel. And he took an interest in me. Every time I'd walk in the door of that meeting room with my wife, I'd just get one or two steps in the room, and he'd come and shake my hand, and he'd look deeply into my eyes. He'd say, how are you doing? And he gave me some 12-step work to do. And every week, about Wednesday or Thursday, I'd start thinking, oh, hurry up Saturday. I want to go and see my friend down there. I owe it all to my higher power that I choose to call God and all you wonderful sober people. I can see myself in you all. And again, I'm not from the South, but I think that's the way AA is supposed to work. We come to the meetings and, hey, I did that. Oh, yeah, I was like that. And I finally became rid of my denial, and I don't think I did that. I give all the credit, all glory and honor to God. People told me what to do when I came here, and it worked. I'm about out of gas. I want to tell you, I'm ever so happy. I'm a sober man tonight. And I have not had a drink for over 37 years, and I just love being sober.
You've been listening to Restoring the Soul. To learn more about our intensive counseling programs where we cultivate freedom and wholeness of heart, visit restoringthesoul.com. That's restoringthesoul.com.
You already know we live in a pornified world, but most of us are at a loss for how to navigate this sea of temptation. It's either ceaseless striving on the one hand or giving in to brokenness on the other. But doesn't the gospel offer us another way? The truth is that our sexual struggles are not actually about sex, but about a misdirected, God-given longing for deep connection. Dig deeper in my book, Surfing for God, Discovering the Divine Desire Beneath Sexual Struggle.